Medicinal cannabis has been a hotly debated issue in recent years. It was legalised in 2016, but for patients who say it's the only thing that eases their suffering, access is still not guaranteed. Like other drugs, medicinal cannabis is regulated by the Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA, an agency of the federal government. But critics say this system simply isn't working. Ian McGregor is a professor of psychopharmacology and academic director of the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics at Sydney University, which was established to research medicinal cannabis. Ian, welcome to Life Matters.
Good to be here, Hilary.
So medicinal cannabis was legalised in Australia 3 years ago. Under the current system, if you're a patient that wants to access it, what do you need to do?
Well, it is a little bit complicated. I guess the first thing you might do is go along to your GP and have a discussion, but you may well find that your GP is very cautious because GPs don't tend to be educated in this space. And we actually did a survey that was published last year showing that GPs felt very uncertain about this and required more education and often weren't aware of the access pathways. These pathways are quite complicated. Generally, you have to have exhausted conventional prescription medications and then have a doctor, usually a specialist, put in an application to the TGA on your behalf, the Therapeutics Goods Administration, making the case for why medicinal cannabis might be suitable for your condition. And often that's quite difficult because the evidence base for medicinal cannabis across different conditions can be rather patchy.
And we'll go into some more detail about that later. But if you do go through those hurdles, what happens when you get to the pharmacy end of that transaction?
Well, you may get a big shock and find that the product that is available is well outside your financial means. And that is one of the major issues. There's the access issue for patients at the moment, a somewhat convoluted process that doesn't guarantee success. And then if you do get the requisite paperwork, you may find that the product is just so expensive that it's impossible for you to pay for it. And let's remember that people with serious medical conditions are often doing it very tough financially.
Are we ever going to see these products go on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, do you think?
No, I mean, the problem at the moment is really that cannabis products are what's called unregistered medicines in Australia. So they're not conventional prescription medications that have been approved through the normal pipeline that the TGA has. And it's just a legal fact that unregistered medicines can't be subsidised under the PBS. So really, we'd require the federal parliament to come up with an alternative way of subsidising these medicines that didn't involve PBS subsidy.
And the TGA response to that is, quote, the TGA is unable to comment on the specific cost of unapproved medicines, but an analysis published last year by the Cannabis Access Clinics, which is publicly available, suggested that product prices fell by 50% over 12 months. And if you do get to the stage of accessing it, I'm wondering, just to skip back a second, what about if a doctor becomes an authorised prescriber, if they can perhaps skip a couple of the steps and become the hub that patients can come to for scripts? Is that an easier option?
That is another option. The scheme I was referring to is the Special Access Scheme B, which is for an individual patient. But in some conditions, you can get a specialist that can get approval to prescribe a specific product to a whole class of patients. And an example of that in Australia is paediatric neurologists who sometimes have this authorised prescriber status to prescribe specialised cannabis products to children with severe paediatric epilepsy. And they're probably the major category of authorised prescribers in Australia at present. There are some GPs, I believe, who have become authorised prescribers, but it's quite a high bar to jump over, and there's a lot of paperwork involved. And you also need to get approval from an ethics committee as well, which can put another hurdle in your way.
And Ian, is it a uniform system in your experience? Is there a consistency to the decisions made and across the states as well?
I think you have to be a little bit kind towards the TGA. They're basically They've inherited a system from the politicians and they're charged with implementing it. And I know the head of the TGA is very fond of pointing out that particular fact. In some cases, however, you also have a state apparatus that provides a parallel approval process that needs to be negotiated. And in the first couple of years of medicinal cannabis access, that was really a kind of double jeopardy for patients, because often the state approval process was even more convoluted and exacting than the federal one. Fortunately, Greg Hunt introduced legislation to harmonize through the COAG process the state and federal approvals. And at the moment, we have this harmonization that has made things a little bit easier for patients, except in Tasmania, where there's still a state apparatus that has to be negotiated.
You're here listening to Ian McGregor, Professor of Psychopharmacology at the University of Sydney and Academic Director of the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics. And also with us today is Lucy Haslam. She's a retired nurse and the Executive Director of United in Compassion, which she co-founded when her son Dan wanted to use cannabis to ease the side effects of his cancer treatment. Lucy, welcome.
Thanks, Hilary.
Tell us about your son Dan and how he felt cannabis affected his experience.
I guess the thing with Dan was cannabis wasn't a first resort. It was a last resort. And actually my husband, who was ex-drug squad, and I, very anti-cannabis people at that stage, we encouraged him to try it because he was so ill after 4 years of chemotherapy. He was having to be hospitalised every time he had chemotherapy because he would get so ill. And, you know, we were absolutely desperate. He'd tried every antiemetic that was available to him. Nothing worked. And cannabis was life-changing. It was the only thing that kept his head out of a toilet and gave him some quality of life for the last year of his life.
And he died a year before the law changed, legalising medicinal cannabis. When that decision happened, Lucy, you hailed that as a win for patients like your son. How do you feel about that decision now?
Oh, look, I'm absolutely incredibly disappointed. I guess I need a stronger word. I would say disgusted. I think the outcome for patients has been very poor. There are people out there suffering immensely. People like Dan, people with children with intractable epilepsy, all manner of conditions. And really, because of the obstacles that this pathway has put in place in front of them, that they basically have to rely on the black market. And you know, I think that's really rather poor public health policy that's in fact driving people to the black market in droves.
So you're saying that legalisation hasn't stamped out the black market. What are you hearing from families?
Well, from families and also from black market suppliers who I'm in regular contact with, they can't keep up with the demand. it's actually, you know, one thing that we have done, I guess, is create this incredible awareness about the benefits of cannabis. And that's, you know, more people know about it now, so more people are trying it. And people don't want to actually use the black market. They'd much rather a legal pathway. But the legal pathway, as Ian's just described, is so difficult that really, you know, it's all about, for patients, it's all about relieving suffering of themselves, of their loved ones. And so they're prepared to be criminals. They're prepared to run the gauntlet of the black market and to use that because, you know, the obstacles are too great to the legal market, including the price, which is a very big factor.
We're hearing about the black market on the text line too. Jen says, I have MS, multiple sclerosis, and have been using medicinal cannabis for a few years now for painful muscle spasms with quite some success. When prescribing cannabis became legal, my GP told me that she would have to jump through so many hoops, it was impractical for her. So she said that she would prefer to send her patients to my supplier. That's a pretty amazing thing. Ian, I'd like to go back to you. I understand a number of clinics have been set up to help doctors with the approval process. And the TGA says over 4,000 scripts have been approved in the last 12 months. There are 54 authorised prescribers across Australia. How big are you saying the unmet need is still in that situation?
Well, it's absolutely huge. I mean, our best guess, and it's a conservative guess, is that there's probably 100,000 Australians using illicit medicinal cannabis. So they're self-medicating with products that they either grow themselves or that they get from friends. And we've done a couple of surveys. We did a survey in 2016 of this category of patient, and we had no problem recruiting almost 2,000 patients in 2016 to fill in our survey. And we've recently repeated that survey and again have got about 2,000 responses. And one of the questions was, you know, over the last 2 years, have you been able to access official medicinal cannabis? Has your behaviour changed? And it was just a very tiny minority, I think less than 1.5%, that said yes. So we have the situation which, as Lucy says, the illicit medicinal cannabis users would far prefer to have a regulated product that they can get inexpensively from their local pharmacy, rather than go through the process of breaking the law and having products that are not quality assured, where the cannabinoid content is by no means certain. So we have this kind of impasse. And I think you can have a look at other foreign jurisdictions. So, for example, Germany introduced medicinal cannabis access around about the same time as Australia. And in 2018, there was 110,000 scripts written in Germany for medicinal cannabis, next to which are 3,000 to 4,000 that the TGA boasts about, looks rather puny.
What's the population difference between Germany and Australia?
It's about 80 million in Germany, and you know we've got, what, 25 million or so in Australia, so that doesn't explain it. Canada, 38 million, has 350,000 official medicinal cannabis patients. So I think that gives us a perspective on the international situation and puts Australia really at the bottom of the league table. I mean, maybe the UK is slightly beneath us, but they're very late bloomers when it comes to medicinal cannabis. But I think we could do much better on our report card.
The AMA, though, is really concerned that this level of interest is partly fueled by media stories and politics and not really based on the evidence. The AMA said last year the evidence is not robust enough, not precise enough, not clear enough that it can benefit large numbers of people for particular conditions. Shouldn't we take the time to be cautious, do the trials, do the tests and let the TGA run it that way?
I think that's probably the key point. And what I always say is, you know, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. That is, if people are reporting that they get huge benefits, and we know that's the case, in a whole load of different conditions for which clinical trials haven't been run. And let's be frank here that the clinical trials haven't been run because of the historical illegality of cannabis. It's been impossible to do clinical trials up until very recently. So I think I would encourage a more compassionate viewpoint where we give cannabis the benefit of the doubt. And if people really are in a desperate situation where prescription medications are not helping their condition and they're suffering, then it's sort of inhumane not to give them that access to medicinal cannabis, which may help.
And just another response from the TGA. It says the TGA has limited role in the administration of clinical trials in Australia. And also, in general, there remains a significant need, they say, for larger, high-quality studies to better explore the potential benefits, limitations and safety issues associated with medicinal cannabis treatment across a range of health conditions and symptoms. So, Ian and Lucy, it looks like you're on the same page in some sense with the TGA. Ian, I'm wondering how fast can those trials be done? Is it fast enough to meet the needs of patients?
Well, we're doing what we can at Lambert Initiative, and we've identified a range of conditions where we think the clinical trial evidence can be built rather quickly. So, for example, next month we'll be launching the first ever good quality clinical trial in insomnia at the Wolcock Institute in Sydney. We've got a trial in Tourette's syndrome, which is just launching up in Queensland. We'll also have trials in alcohol dependence and withdrawal this year. And there's a very interesting trial down in Melbourne with Paul Amminger's group for highly anxious teenagers. And here we're using the non-psychoactive or non-intoxicating component of cannabis called cannabidiol to treat children who have severe mental health problems. And it's a kind of inversion of what we normally hear about cannabis, where, you know, cannabis is supposed to be disastrous for youth mental health. And here we're actually getting very promising signs that a certain component within the plant may have strong benefits in mental health for children that are doing it tough.
Lucy Haslam, at United in Compassion, you'd be hearing from sufferers but also families of sufferers of a range of conditions. What kinds of conditions are people contacting you with regard to medicinal cannabis about?
Oh, look, I think the vast majority would be patients with chronic pain, things like endometriosis, which is not recognised by the guidances as being something that would qualify for medicinal cannabis lawfully. A lot of cancer patients, a great number of patients with terminal illness, so palliative care. So it really is a quality of life drug. And, you know, just listening to you saying that the TGA and the AMA are concerned about the lack of clinical evidence, these patients are doing it anyway. So they're already putting themselves in harm's way by using unregulated product. So, you know, that's the elephant in the room that nobody seems to want to recognise. People are doing it anyway, and they're doing it in their tens, if not hundreds of thousands. So, you know, clinical trials are great for the blanket approach, but we're talking about people that with very individual needs. We're talking about an endocannabinoid system that varies from person to person. So it really is about personalised medicine. And in this case, I don't think randomised double-blind controlled trials that take a long time and cost a lot of money are appropriate. Like Ian said, we need to give cannabis the benefit of the doubt, and we need to make people safe as we can, as quickly as we can.
Lucy, we've had a comment on text message about dosage. How do you manage it? My husband's a GP and he's unclear about that aspect of it. How are people managing that idea of how to work out how much to have?
Look, they're guessing. A lot of it is guesswork, you know. You hear the term all the time, start low and go slow, and that's about the best guess that patients have. They don't even know what they're taking. They don't even know if batch to batch is the same or different. You know, I got a message yesterday from a mother who had been having great success with her child with intractable epilepsy. She got a bad batch from the black market, and that sent him completely backwards. You know, these are the things that people are dealing with on a daily basis, and the government at the moment is just completely ignoring that whole side of the argument. And, you know, it's the head in the sand sort of stuff. You know, the AMA are becoming, doctors are becoming irrelevant because they don't want to be interested. They don't want to be involved. Their patients are actually crying out for them to be involved. It's all about education. And, you know, if there was motivation to get that education, the education is there. For some reason, there just seems to be this lack of, lack of the basic humanity that cares about people that are really sick and suffering.
And I'm wondering if I could finish with you, Ian McGregor, who should regulate this drug if not the Therapeutic Goods Administration?
Well, other countries have set up an independent regulator to manage medicinal cannabis. And I think in some ways that's quite prudent, because normal regulation of drugs involves what we call novel molecular entities, so products that have never really been given to humans before and go through these very careful and painstaking clinical trials that can take years and years and years. But here we have a drug that is, you know, used by 200 million humans every year. It's not as if it's a dark art and we have no idea what it does to the human brain and body. So I think a very practical, common sense approach would be to recognise the overwhelming safety of cannabis. No one dies on cannabis. Admittedly, there are vulnerabilities. You need to get your dosing right. But an independent regulator probably would have made a lot of sense back in 2014 when Richard Di Natale suggested that, because cannabis doesn't necessarily fit into the boxes that the TGA likes to deal with.
And that discussion, this discussion today has made that quite clear. Lucy Haslam, thank you. And Ian McGregor, you too. Thank you so much for being on the program. Lucy's an executive director and founder of United in Compassion. Ian McGregor is Professor of Psychopharmacology and Academic Director at the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics at Sydney University. And we did approach Federal Minister Health Minister Greg Hunt for a response to concerns about the current system, but we were referred to the TGA, which said the TGA is always working to ensure its processes are comprehensive and adequately safeguard the Australian public without providing unnecessary regulatory burden. You're listening to Life Matters.